My apologies up front, that's all of the German I know. My name is Jeff Woolsey. I'm a Principal Program Manager in the Microsoft Cloud and Enterprise Division, and it's a pleasure to be here in Germany this morning talking with you about our next generation cloud with Azure Stack, Nano Server, Windows Server 2016, and more. I literally, just to give you a quick heads up, I could sit here at this podium for the next 3 days telling you what we're doing in our next generation of technology, and I still wouldn't barely scratch the surface of what we're doing. So I apologize up front. I have to pick and choose what I can fit in an hour-long session, and just keep in mind there is so much more. This is a very high-level discussion. I want to start very briefly with the Microsoft Cloud, very quickly, before we get into drilling in much deeper. One of the questions I get asked very often, though, is quite simply, where is it that why are people adopting cloud so fast? And I remember initially a few years ago, people were saying, oh, it's cost. It's about reducing costs as quickly as possible. And cost is certainly a component of the equation, but really the reason why we're seeing it is the same reason that Gartner quotes, which is agility. People are realizing, yes, in addition to reducing costs, it allows you to do things faster. It allows you to innovate faster. It allows your business to grow very much quicker. Instead of procuring hardware, setting things up, managing crazy large services, setting up these things, you can literally be going in just a couple clicks, and taking advantage of cloud services. And I'll talk about this in depth. In terms of the Microsoft Cloud, very quickly, I just want to go over this for some people who don't understand, but very briefly, when we talk about the cloud at Microsoft, it's very simple. We think of it as three legs to a stool, and it starts with the private cloud. And the private cloud, quite simply, that's Windows Server and System Center, but I can easily describe the private cloud in one word. That word is control. At the very end of the day, I don't know how many times I've talked with customers, whether it's been in Redmond or whether it's been in Europe, and someone will say, Jeff, I have a workload that has to run in a German data center on German soil by German citizens. Are you going to try and force me up into Azure? And my answer is absolutely not. This has nothing to do with technology in any way whatsoever. This is about compliance. This is about regulatory. This is about data sovereignty. Let's help you build the best private cloud together. If you want to buy all the hardware, you want to pour the concrete, you want to have your folks manage it, fantastic. That's what the private cloud is about. At the same time, we've been making huge investments in Azure. In Azure, our public cloud. And here we have platform as a service, software as a service, infrastructure as a service, and much, much more. Let's just be clear, by the way, up in the public cloud, there's two of us. It's Azure and AWS. That's it. I don't even know who number 4, 5, 6, 7, I get that question asked all the time. You can go look it up for yourselves. But there's really two of us up here. And when it comes to public cloud, I can easily describe the public cloud in one word. And that word is scale. If you watched any of the Sochi Olympics at all last year, it was big at my house. I have a gymnast in the house. She was actually at a meet yesterday. Sochi Olympics, that was actually all done via Azure. We delivered to over 100 million customers, 22 countries, 4 continents, on any device, iOS, Android, PC, phone, you name it. If you watched any of the Sochi Olympics, that was all done via Azure. If you need to scale planet-wide, this is how you do it. That's what the public cloud is all about, and so much more. Finally, we have service providers. Service providers provide customization and reach. Very often, someone will come to me and say, Jeff, I'd like to take a specific server and put this specific server in a specific rack in an Azure data center. I have a key and you have a key. Can we do that for a specific server? And unfortunately, my answer is no. Because in Azure, we don't think at the scale of a single server or even a rack. Just to let you know, when we deploy an Azure stamp, that's a minimum of 1,000 servers. That's the smallest footprint we think of. So if someone needs that type of customization or that type of service level agreement, we've got partners that are happy to do it. And we also know that there are places around the world where we simply don't have a local Azure data center. If you want a data center in Kenya, we don't have one, but we have fantastic partners that are there to provide you one. Here's the most important thing. When it comes to cloud, at Microsoft, we believe in all three of these. You see, if you talk to VMware, VMware will tell you cloud is this thing down in the corner. If you talk to Amazon, Amazon will say, that's not cloud. Amazon will say, no, cloud is up here. We believe that cloud is all three of these. I'm not going to try and push you into one or any of these. That's not my decision. That's your decision. You need to do what makes business sense to you. Our goal is real simple. If you want to run here, fantastic. Let's do that right now. If you want to do this or this, that's all available today right now. Most importantly, if you're like 90% of the people I talk to, you want hybrid so bad that you can taste it. That's what people are telling me they want. They're saying, you know what, Jeff? I want to be able to consume Azure services. I'm using Office 365. I want to use more of the services that are available up there, like Azure Active Directory, disaster recovery, business continuity, media services, CDN, and so much more. But you know what? There are some things that I'm going to keep on premises because you know what? It's really old. It's really legacy. It was never designed for the cloud. And in fact, there are some workloads at the end of the day, I want to be able to go touch the server. I've actually had people tell me, Jeff, at the end of the night, there are a couple of workloads. I literally want to be able to go hug the server. And that's fine. If you want to go hug it, you go right ahead. You do that. The same, but most importantly, we want to let you do what makes most business sense to you. That's how we think about cloud. Now, at the same time, over the last couple of years, we've had the Windows Azure Pack. Azure Pack is free code. We give this to you today. You can download it today. It plugs in the System Center and Windows Server so that you can create your own private cloud. Our service providers are doing it as well, that looks and acts like Azure. Now, we've had this, it's been available for the last 24 months, been extremely popular, but we've gotten one very bit of very loud feedback. Customers have said, you know what, Jeff, we love this. It looks like Azure, because it's literally the Azure portal. We copied the code from Azure and gave it to you. But we've had customers come and say, you know, Jeff, it looks similar to Azure. It's Azure-like and it's Azure-similar, but it's not Azure the same. What I really want is Azure the same. I want to be able to write code. I want to write an application that talks to Azure APIs, the compute APIs, the storage APIs, the network APIs, if I'm running on-premises or in Azure, so that I can write to the same set of APIs. So we've heard you loud and clear. And that's where we're introducing the Microsoft Azure Stack. Azure Stack is about bringing Azure to your data center. Think about it. You can write an application one time that runs here in your private cloud, in your data center, that if you decide, you know what, today this is where I want to be. But in 5 years, where do you want to be? In 5 years, do you want to be up here? Do you want to be over here? Or maybe you decide to move something to the public cloud and realize, you know, you need to move it back. Azure Stack, you can do exactly that. Write an application, run it on premises, and guess what? If you want to move it to Azure, boom, just move it to Azure with no code change. That's what makes this amazing. It's literally the same code that I ran up in our private cloud, I'm running in public cloud, and I will show you this in just a moment. On top of that, we've also made a big investment in Operations Management Suite. One of the big things we've heard is people realizing they have their private clouds. In fact, they probably have multiple private clouds, multiple data centers. You've got stuff running in Azure or AWS. You've got VMware. You've got Linux. You've got Windows Server. How do I manage all this? This is an incredibly difficult task. And in fact, I've asked people, how do you manage all of your infrastructure? And almost everybody says, well, I can't manage all of it because I can't see all of it. I have pockets of this, and I have no way to manage all of this as one big view. People tell me, oh, I would love that. That's what the Operations Management Suite is all about. With the Operations Management Suite, I can monitor your health, your performance, your management, whether it's running in your private cloud, whether it's running in a public cloud on Azure or AWS, whether you're using VMware, whether you're using Hyper-V, whether you're using Windows Server, whether you're using Linux, because it's an Azure service. And we're using Hadoop-based analytics to scan literally millions of servers, bring the intelligence back to you so that you can run your business and your infrastructure and your applications better than ever. So I'll talk more about that. At the end of the day, our goal is real simple. It's to provide you the best cloud whenever and wherever it makes business sense. Now, one of the things I get asked about, and I tend to see that people get tripped up about, is they spend a lot of time looking in the public cloud about infrastructure as a service. I see analysts tend to talk about this. Well, AWS, we think, has this many VMs, and we think Azure has this many VMs. Honestly, who cares? Really? You know what you should care about? This is what you should care about. It's the other services that are available. You want infrastructure as a service? Fine. It's that one little box over there. But do you want machine learning? Do you want Hadoop? Do you want API management, Logic Apps? Do you want multi-factor authentication so you can have many-factor authentication into your business for security? Do you want content delivery network and a CDN? Do you want a Redis cache and more? This is what public cloud is about, because I'm going to go back to agility for a second. I want to be able to spin up Hadoop. Setting up Hadoop is not trivial. Well, it is if you can just log in Azure and guess what, in a couple of clicks, you're done. Now you can get on to, okay, what is the real goal I'm accomplishing? The goal, the accomplishment should not to be to set up Hadoop. The goal should be to actually do something meaningful with that. This is why cloud, and this is just a few. This isn't, by the way, a complete list by any stretch of the imagination. This is only some of the services that are available in Azure. When it comes to our global data centers, we've been doing crazy work expanding. In fact, I should point out these are regions, not data centers, because each region consists of multiple data centers, because we can do failover between data centers in a region, and we can also do failover between regions. We have more than AWS and Google Cloud combined, and in fact, we're the only ones to have a presence in India, and I'm very excited. I'm sure you heard about this announcement, just happened last week, that we announced two new data centers opening up in Frankfurt and Magdeburg, as well as some others ones coming online, but that's big news, just announced. So I'm very, very excited about that. When it comes to Azure Agility, here are just a few of the releases of in the last 12 months. The beauty of cloud is because we're delivering it on the back end, you literally log into Azure, and guess what? You get new services. You get new features. You could literally log in on a Friday, do your work, go home, spend the weekend, see your friends, see your family, have a good weekend, log back in on a Monday morning, and boom, there are new features, there are new capabilities ready to go. Let's contrast that with how we do data centers today. Today we sell you Windows Server or System Center, or even if it's Linux or whatever, or VMware, whatever, what do? Well, a new version comes out, so now you have to do some sort of migration process, some sort of training is needed to do. You need to upgrade your management consoles. There's some migration paths and training that goes along with that. In the cloud, we just do all the work on the back end, light it up, and guess what? You log in and you got new features. That's the beauty and the agility of cloud. So now let's look at how we're bringing those enhancements on premises. If you look over the last few releases, 2012 was about industry-leading scale and performance. 2012 R2 was about using Azure as a design point. In 2016, it's really cloud-first innovation. And what I mean by this is we are taking features and capabilities that started up in Azure and bringing them down on premises for you for the first time ever. Let me give you a perfect example of that. Remember the Sochi Olympics I just mentioned? So that, the fact that we were able to stream that live, in fact, we set a couple of world records. The USA-Canadian hockey match had over 2.1 million users live logging into it, watching the game real time around the world. And Azure just dynamically expanded and took on the load, dynamically. When the game was over, it shrunk back down to the number of people watching curling, okay? So it could dynamically scale, okay? Well, all of that magic is done in software, through our software-defined networking, through our software load balancers, our network controllers, our distributed firewalls, VM chaining, all of these cool things that reside up in Azure. You've never had these capabilities. In fact, I've even had people tell me, Jeff, when I go up and log into Azure, you got all of these really cool networking features. I wish I could have those on premises. Guess what? You're about to get those. In Azure Stack, the software load balancer, the network controller, the distributed firewall, VM training, and more, these things that have resided only up in Azure are coming on premises for the first time ever in Azure Stack. So what is Azure Stack? Well, if you look at Azure at a very high level, we've got cloud infrastructure providing infrastructure as a service and platform as a service, services with the portal. And here are just, again, a few of the icons you saw, the bigger one, the slide just a moment ago, but there's even more than that. Providing services for Windows Server and Linux. All right, so if you look at what we have today, our private cloud consists of Windows Server, System Center, and the Azure Pack. Now I mentioned the Azure Pack is free code you can download today. That's available right now. But again, Azure looks like this. So what we're doing now is we're taking our learnings from Azure and we're bringing those on premises with the Azure stack. Now, one of the very first questions I get asked all the time is, okay, hold it. Jeff, if it's that, why didn't you just give me Azure in the first place? Why did we go through this Azure pack thing? Simple answer. I could have actually given you Azure on premises a few years ago, but here's the thing. I would have said, by the way, you'll need a minimum of 1,000 servers. Who's ready to buy 1,000 servers, eh? Anybody? It's too big. So what happened was we've learned a lot. With Azure Pack, you guys told us straight out, this is very much what you wanted to see, but you wanted Azure the same. Not Azure kind of, not Azure similar, you want Azure the same. That's what we're delivering. So, what does it look like? Well, let me switch on over and give you a peek. All right, this is a preview. What you see right now, first of all, this is Azure. All right, let's be clear. This is in Azure right now. So what I have here is I have an application that's running on Azure. And in fact, you can see it consists of a web app, some virtual machines, and some more. So if we look here, you can see I've got VMs, I've got network interfaces, I've got public IP addresses, I've got a PaaS SQL database, I've got PaaS storage, so that's tables, queues, blobs. I've got a web app. So this isn't just Java or HTML or some Node.js. This is what you would expect from a modern cloud application. It consists of IaaS and PaaS resources working together. Well, what does that mean? It means, number one, it can be elastic. It can grow. It can shrink. The other thing I want to point out is we thought about how do we develop an application model that's future-proof. What do I mean by that? Well, anybody know what the hot technology is going to be in 10 years? I have no idea. I can tell you containers came out of nowhere. All of a sudden, everybody's talking about containers. That's only 18 months old. 3 years ago, no one would have even said the word container, and if they did, they meant Tupperware. Okay? Now you're saying containers, and everybody's like, okay, what is it? We're all running around asking about containers, and I'll get to containers shortly. The important thing is we designed this to be future-proof. Today, this consists of VMs. It consists of IaaS. It consists of PaaS. Guess what? You want containers? We'll plug containers in the model. It's pluggable. In 10 years from now, when something new that comes up that we haven't thought about, guess what? It'll plug right in here. So we've made this future-proof. All right. So let's dig in a little bit. Let's just take a look, for example, at storage. You can see here, again, I mentioned this is PaaS storage. So this consists of tables, blobs. And in fact, you can see from a blob standpoint, this consists in the Azure East location, East region. So if I want to take a look at, after I've deployed the application, of course, I want to make sure that the right people have access. So what I want to be able to do is provide role-based access control. So it's important that, yes, I've deployed the application, but you know what? I want to make sure the right people have access, people need to back up, or who the root admins are, or who just who are my users. So I can go in here and add some users, and you can see I can get as granular as you want, from contributors to owners to readers, et cetera. All right. Now, this is what it looks like in Azure. Well, how did we deploy this application? From a deployment standpoint, we just used a little bit of PowerShell. In fact, you can see this is 4 lines of PowerShell. And in fact, when I deployed this application to Azure versus Azure Stack, I used the same 4 lines of PowerShell. There's one difference. You'll notice the location variable here says Chicago. That's what I used for Azure Stack. Okay? For Azure, it went to an Azure data center. For Azure Stack, it actually went to a lab here in Chicago. All right, so if this is Azure, what does Azure Stack look like? Well, I'm about to warn you, this could be the most boring demo ever, because when I switch on over here, there, in fact, is the same exact application. The difference is here, we color-coded the screen black, so you could see the difference, but it, in fact, it's the same UI. It's a different URL, because this is not an Azure URL, this is an Azure Stack, But in fact, there is the same exact application. With no code changes, there's my IaaS VMs, there's my network interfaces, there's my virtual NICs, there's my PaaS storage, and my PaaS SQL and more. So what does this look like? Let me switch on over here to the admin view. All right. What does this look like from the administrator viewpoint? So everything I've shown you so far has been from the tenant. Me logging into Azure, me creating VMs, me running my applications, me doing this. But if you're actually managing this cloud, an Azure Stack cloud in your data center, what does that look like? Well, you can see, what you do is you create plans. Plans is where you take resources, providers, quotas, put them together, and define things that people can consume, whether it's SQL, whether it's storage, whether it's networking. And in fact, I get asked all the time, Jeff, can I just create an IaaS plan? So let's show you what an IaaS plan would look like. I'm going to add a new plan. I'm going to go ahead and give it a name. I'm going to choose a resource group. And now I get to determine what services are part of this plan. Is this a storage plan? Is this a networking plan? Is this a compute plan? In my case, I want this to be all of the above. And as I mentioned before with networking, this networking, again, this is the first time you're going to get our software load balancer, our network controller, our virtual firewalls, a whole bunch of capabilities that have only been available in Azure, now for the first time available in Azure Stack. So now I've selected those, and I want to go configure some of the quotas, for example, on my compute. So I'm going to determine where I'm going to deploy this. And I don't necessarily want unlimited VMs because I'm running this on premises. So let's go with that. Click OK. Click OK. And just like this, I'm now creating this plan, and I'm creating an IaaS infrastructure. Now, while that's happening, let me come on over here and show you some storage that I created earlier. And in fact, you can see I've got 7 nodes. Here are my API requests in the last hour. And in fact, in case you're wondering, you know, there are file shares behind this. I'm providing some blob storage. You may be wondering, what's the storage behind all of this? Well, if you're used to what we've been doing in 2012 and 2012 R2 in the scale-out file server, this will look very familiar to you because, in fact, we're using the scale-out file server on the back end to provide our software-defined storage. So think about what you've seen here. It's been a quick tour of what does it look like from a tenant point of view. Azure and Azure Stack, they look the same. Like I said, we actually changed the color so you could tell black and blue, one versus the other. Otherwise, people go, I don't see any difference. That's the point. The point is that you're running this on premises and you're controlling it. It's on your terms. And then from the back end, you get to provision your storage, your networking, your compute, define what those plans look like, define those quotas, and make those available to your folks internally. So that's a quick trip through Azure Stack. So, Operations Management Suite. I mentioned this briefly already, and I want to make sure folks see this. This is available today. This is available right now. It's been available actually for many months. And I would urge you to please try this. It's available. In fact, you can try it for free. It's very quick, very easy. To give you an idea, here's what the main dashboard looks like, and you can customize all of this. But the thing I want to point out is each one of these tiles is an intelligence pack. Whether it's backup, whether it's security, whether it's Active Directory, whether it's automation, malware assessment, and much, much more. But what this does is you can either through integration with System Center or by working or by installing agents in your systems, whether they're running in Azure, AWS, locally, wherever they may reside, we bring all of this data up into our analytics, our Hadoop-based analytics, and then we're able to basically look for trends, come back and spit out to you the information that's going to help you run your infrastructure better. So for example, we may come back and say, hey, we've noticed your domain controllers are set up in this particular way, but you're missing some of our best practices. Here's what you should be doing to help harden your domain controllers. Or we've noticed, you know what, you've got a number of servers that are missing critical updates. Or from a malware protection, we've noticed that your antivirus is out of date, or much, much more. You can then drill in and create your own custom dashboards as well. And think about, you know, you could have guys on your team that are very specifically focused on compute, or on storage or on networking, so they could create their own custom dashboards. You can also share these as well. It makes this very simple and very easy to bring the data up to you that's most important. If you want to take a deeper dive here, for example, here is actually looking at configuration change. And as anybody who's managed a large amount of systems knows, one of the things you keep an eye out for is if you see a lot of churn on a couple of servers, if you see, whoa, there's been a lot of changes going on from a configuration standpoint, that usually means something is about, potentially something could be going wrong there. Or you want to take a look and understand why all of that change is happening. Moving on to storage, one of the interesting questions we get asked about Azure all the time is Azure storage. In fact, I hear this specifically all the time. Jeff, people will come up to me and say, I notice that when I go up to Azure, I can get gigabytes and gigabytes of storage for a fraction of a penny. I'd like that on premises, please. Can you tell me whose SAN vendor you use? How do you get that type of storage? First of all, none of that is on a SAN. It is all software-defined storage. None of that. SAN couldn't meet the cost, performance, reliability. It couldn't meet the metrics that we require. Software-defined storage is about changing the way we architect storage. Over the past many decades, the whole concept of SANs has been, hey, you make these disks specially hardened, special disks with special firmware, and then you do multi-path I/O and multiple power, and you make this system that'll quote-unquote never fail, except that it does, because everything fails. With software-defined storage, you change the architecture and you build a fabric that is intelligent and self-healing. When you do a write, we're actually writing to three locations simultaneously, none of those in the same server, none of those in the same rack. So if a server goes down or a rack goes down or a power supply goes, doesn't matter, because we're writing to multiple locations. If we detect, whoops, this rack went down, that's fine, we're writing to two other places, we detect the failure and start writing to a third new one. That's what software-defined storage is all about. We've been delivering this for the past few releases in Windows Server 2012 and R2 with the scale-out file server. The scale-out file server is fault-tolerant storage. Literally, disks can go down, servers can go down, it'll keep going because it's writing to multiple locations simultaneously. Now, one of the biggest things we've learned is customers said to us, we really, really like this, but there's some inherent limitations in SAS, Serial Attached SCSI. And we recognize that. So we said, you know what, we like what we've been doing here and we're gonna continue to do this, but what we're gonna do is take our learnings from Azure and again, bring those back on premises. And that's what we're doing with Storage Spaces Direct. Storage Spaces Direct very much mimics how we think about storage up in Azure. Okay, there's a lot of text up here, but I will easily explain this. You need storage, you take a server, put a bunch of disks in it, plug it into your network. You have storage. Do you need more storage? Take a server, plug in a bunch of disks, plug it into the network. You have more storage. It's that simple. That's what Storage Spaces Direct is all about giving you scale-out, fault-tolerant, ridiculously optimized storage that just simply is fault-tolerant using mainstream servers, mainstream storage. The beauty of this is that it can be deployed in a couple of different ways. One of the big buzzwords these days is a topic, is a word called hyperconverged. Anybody heard the term hyperconverged? Yep, a few hands going up. Yes, it's a term being thrown around a lot. Everybody seems to love saying the word. Hyperconverged means quite simply, I'm running my hypervisor and my storage on the same server. That's all it means. It's a fun word, everybody loves getting excited about it, but that's all it means. I'm running a hypervisor and storage on the same server. My laptop is hyperconverged, okay? The nice thing about hyperconverged is it's a great way to deploy small to medium-sized footprints. If I need to deploy 4 nodes, 8 nodes, 16 nodes, this is a great way to go. You put your storage, you put your hypervisors in, you plug them in and you go. If you need something bigger than that, 6,400, even more, you don't want that. You want a disaggregated approach. And there's a very good reason for that. In this approach, you've got separate compute nodes and separate storage nodes. And the reason why is really simple. Because you want to be able to scale each tier independently. You don't want to be locked into one size for the tier. Again, this is great for small to medium, but this is what you're going to want for larger deployments. If you realize that, you know what, you have workloads that need more memory and more compute, great, add more servers up here. If you have workloads that need more capacity, need more IOPS, or you're more driven here from a storage perspective, great, add more here. But it gives you the flexibility to do either one. In this model, in the hyper-converged approach, every one of those nodes has to be the same. Every amount of memory and amount of storage in one of those servers has to be the same, because if it's not, good luck trying to get consistent performance across the cluster. It'll be crazy difficult, if not impossible. That's why we're offering both of these, because there are definite use cases for both, which is what we're doing in Storage Spaces Direct. Of course, on top of this, you want to make sure that whatever workloads you're running on top of this, you can easily give hard quality of service to, which is why we've done storage quality of service as well. So think about it. You're running workloads that have high performance I/O requirements. You're running SQL, you're running some big database, but you've also got some print servers, some domain controllers, some other things that, you know what, don't require much storage performance. And in fact, my print servers, if you need to wait a little bit longer to print something, that's fine. Just don't ever starve my SQL server. So we have very flexible and granular I/O policy per virtual hard disk, per VM, per service, or for tenant. And we'll do hard minimums, hard maximums, so you can guarantee the performance and meet the SLAs that you need for your infrastructure. And of course, to make it easy to get to this, we're providing rolling upgrades. With rolling upgrades, I can have a 2012 R2 cluster and in place upgrade it to 2016. So the first time you've ever been able to do this. We did some of the work in 2012 R2, but we've now done and completed everything you need to actually have a mixed mode cluster. So for example, you could have a 12-node cluster, a 16-node cluster running 2012 R2. You drain all of the workloads off, take the server out of the cluster, upgrade it to 2016, bring it back into the cluster, move workloads over, and now you have 2016 and 2012 R2 servers running in the same cluster. You literally walk through every node in the cluster, draining all of the workloads, upgrading them in place. And then when you're done, you upgrade the cluster functional level from 2012 R2 to 2016, and you've just done an upgrade in place without any downtime at all. So that's one of the awesome things, making it really easy to take this to 2016. And you can do this yourself step by step, or you can do this completely automated with VMM, kick back, and it'll actually upgrade the entire cluster for you, and when you're done, it's done. On top of that, we're not done. We did a lot in storage. Another big one is introducing storage replica. So we introduced Hyper-V replica 2 releases ago. We were the first ones to include VM replication in the box. That was Hyper-V. That was way back in 2012. But one of the things we wanted to do was we wanted to add some more complex scenarios to this, which is customers say, Jeff, I've got two different sites. I've got a site in New York and New Jersey. And what I'd like to be able to do is multi-site clustering. Today you can do that, but generally it means you're going to add some third-party replication software in the middle to do all of that. In 2016, we actually include that replication now in the box with storage replica for the first time. This is both synchronous and asynchronous. We give you both options because it really depends on the speed of your network pipes. If you've got fast pipes with low latency, you can do synchronous. If you're trying to stretch a really long distance, basically if you're trying to go over 150 kilometers, you're going to be doing asynchronous. But that is actually in the box now for the first time ever. So we've been building our disaster recovery technologies, our business continuity technologies for some time now, and we've been doing it via Azure Site Recovery. As I mentioned, we introduced Hyper-V Replica back in 2012 in an R2, and it's gotten better and better each time. And we made it really easy. That was one of our goals. You simply right-click on a VM, and you start replicating, and it's that simple. Well, our customers came back to us and said, Jeff, this is great, but I need a way to manage multiple sites. I've got a site in Seattle, I've got a site in Los Angeles, I've got a site in Paris, I've got a site in Munich, I've got a site in Florida. And I want to be able to see all of this from a single console. Oh, and by the way, we still want this to be easy to use. So what did we do? Well, we introduced Azure Site Recovery. With Azure Site Recovery, this is an Azure service. This is about providing you a spectacular hybrid experience. So all of the replication still occurs between your sites. Doesn't go up to Azure and back down, that would be ridiculous. It stays between your sites. But what Azure does is it manages the orchestration. So your runbooks, for example, that you'll create, the configuration for your disaster recovery and business continuity, that's all done up there. And the beauty of it is, because it's an Azure service, this is all delivered via HTML5, I can do this on my phone. I can do this on any device. I don't need some rich client, I don't need to install anything. This will run on my iOS, my Android, my whatever. It just works. Well, we delivered this for Hyper-V quite some time ago. And what happened was VMware customers and customers that have physical hardware came back and they said, Jeff, this is great, but I really like this for my VMware and my physical because I have that too. So we said, okay, not a problem. Done. So if you want to do VMware, physical, and Hyper-V, it's all there through Azure Site Recovery. Then the next bit of feedback we got was, well, Jeff, this means I have to have a secondary site. In some cases, people said, I have a secondary site, I'm trying to get rid of it. In some cases, people said, I don't have a secondary site, and that's about $100 million that I don't want to spend today. So we said, okay, fine. You'll be able to now also do site recovery directly up to Azure. We can be your target as well. And we support that not only for Hyper-V, but for VMware and physical as well, giving you a single solution to do all of these. So again, the choice is up to you, but it's about providing you a fantastic hybrid experience. If you want this to be in your data centers and you want to just manage replication between your data centers, great. If you want to use Azure, we've got that option as well. So, security. I got to say, we've been doing some really, really hard look at what's happening in the security world. And we've been doing this for a very, very long time. The bad guys are getting worse. They're getting more sophisticated. They're doing all sorts of interesting things to try and get drill in deeper than ever before. They're trying to figure out how we get even lower into the system. Is there a way we can get into BIOSes? Is there a way we can get as close to the hardware as possible? The other thing is they're looking at humans. Because at the end of the day, the best way to get into your system is social attacks. They're looking at your infrastructure. Who are your admins in your company? How many admins do you have in your company? Who are the domain admins in your company? Those are the guys they really want to get. They want your credentials very badly. And they realize, you know what? We can continue to exploit the technology and they'll continue to fight it, but they're very much looking at the social aspect as well. Because once they have an admin's credentials, they can do a lot of damage. Meet Edward Snowden. Perhaps you've heard that name. So, we've been doing a lot of interesting work and looking at all of these variety of vectors. There's only a couple of things I can talk about today, but there's a ton of work we've been doing across the board. Just-in-time administration, JIT. This is one thing I'm really excited about. Think about this for a second. If I'm a domain admin, one day I become the domain admin, and someone comes down from on high and says, Jeff, you are the domain admin. Woo, okay, fanfare, balloons, cake, great, wonderful. Guess what? The domain admin means I'm domain admin like forever. This is like an ongoing thing, which means my credentials are now super, super important. That's not what we want. My work on a daily basis as a domain admin, how often do I really need to be the domain admin? Okay, maybe I need to change a setting on the corporate firewall or something. But for the most of the time, my day-to-day should not be logging in as the domain admin. What you really want, in fact, is nobody logging in as domain admin. This should be a very time-limited time of work. So with just-in-time administration, this is the way it works. I need to do something that requires my domain admin credentials? Fine. Most 99% of the time, I'm running as a regular user. For me to do that work, I have to commit to a workflow. And I have to go through a workflow process that says, hey folks, I need to go make a change on the corporate firewall. And a number of people have to vote and say, yes, he gets approval. And I get that credential for an hour. Not forever, for an hour. I then go do my work, and by the way, they have to get approval, so maybe I require 3 votes of yes. I get 3 votes of yes, great. I have an hour to go do my job. When I'm done, great. An hour later, guess what? I'm no longer domain admin. So what this is about is reducing the time and only giving me domain credentials when I really, really need it. But But for the rest of the time, my credentials don't give me that access. That's one really cool thing, and we'll talk more about that as we get work on 2016. But one of the biggest things I want to talk about is this one on the left. Hardware-rooted security, shielded virtual machines on guarded fabric. Let me explain the problem. There's a number of problems in trying to protect high-value assets. Problem number one, on any platform, any platform, Unix, Linux, VMware, macOS, Windows, a local admin can do anything on the box. If this is my server, I am God. I can do anything. You can encrypt all you want. You can put your VMs here. You can put your secret diaries here. You can encrypt till you're blue in the face. Doesn't matter. I can undo anything you do because I am admin. But you're saying, Jeff, I encrypted it. I have the keys. No. You see, you have the keys, but when you unencrypt it, those will be in memory. And I am admin. I can see memory. I can get your keys. I can unencrypt it. Game over. This is an important point because this problem has existed since the dawn of computing. I meet with a lot of interesting agencies. They ask me this question every year. Jeff, what are you guys doing to help protect against the local admin? And for the longest time, our answer has been, we're looking at it, but there's not a lot we can do. We're about to change that in a very big way. Problem number two, any seized or infected host admin can access guest VMs. The bad guys know this and are targeting these individuals. Like I said before, if I'm the domain admin, trust me, the bad guys have figured out who I am in the company and they're coming after me. And they're sending me emails. Hey, Jeff, click here to win a free trip to Hawaii. And I only have to do that one time when I'm really, really tired and really want to go to Hawaii before they install something bad. And social attacks is how they're doing it. Number three, tenant VMs are exposed to storage and network attacks while unencrypted. I hear this all the time. Jeff, we encrypt our storage. Really? Fantastic. Is that at rest or in flight or both? Most of the time the answer is, if they're doing encryption, is at rest. And then when I say in flight, they all look at me like I'm what? What'd you just say? Yeah. You gotta do both. You gotta do both or it doesn't matter. And then finally, the last one, and this is a real big one, is it's impossible to identify legitimate hosts without hardware-based verification. What do I mean by that? Let me show you. I'm running my confidential financial VM. This has all my company secrets in it. This has all my operating budget, all my salaries, everything. This is like the super secret, most important financial VM we got. Is there any way that I know that I'm running on this hypervisor and on Contoso Fabric? No. This is true on any hypervisor platform at all, period. VMware, Hyper-V, Xen, KVM, you name it. There's no way to tell. You just fire up a VM, you click start, and it just runs. Doesn't know, it doesn't look down there, it doesn't say, yeah, this looks like real Contoso Fabric. Well, it doesn't know. Well, there are problems with this. Number one, bad guys. The bad guys are trying to attack the social admin, get his credentials. Once they get his credentials, they're gonna try and get their hands on that VM and attack that VM on his own local fabric, i.e. his laptop. Scenario number two, trusted admin has a bad day, also called Edward Snowden, okay? He was your trusted admin on Friday. He had a bad performance review Friday afternoon. Over the weekend, he was very upset. He decided he's gonna leave the company, but when he comes in on Monday morning, he's gonna take a USB key and he's gonna copy a couple of those VMs and take them home with him, and he's going to embarrass the company. Because, again, today he's a good guy, but something made him change his mind. And scenario number three is the whoops moment. Scenario number three is, hey, you know what? We're gonna take some old hardware, we're gonna recycle it, we're gonna bring in some new servers. That old hardware is gonna go off to a recycler who's supposed to degauss them, destroy them. Instead, he sells those hard drives on eBay, he forgot to zero them, and guess what? Now everybody's got your company information. All three of those scenarios, completely real. I've got real scenarios for every one of those. So, how do you solve this problem? We've been looking at this very closely. Well, what you do is you create a guarded fabric. You create server storage and networking. It says, this is contoso.com. This is my fabric. Next, the guarded fabric provides an attested fabric where guests can be encrypted, and the VMs, the keys for the encryption, are outside the view of the admin. And these VMs are protected at rest or in flight. Now you create shielded VMs. A shielded VM, by definition, means I can only run on a named fabric. So this VM can only run on contoso.com, on this Contoso fabric. If I live migrate this to another server in my infrastructure, it's still in Contoso, but it's not part of the guarded fabric, won't run. Won't start. I can't look inside it. I can't mount it because it's not running on the guarded fabric. I can migrate it back and it'll run just fine. All the features you expect to use in your VM just work, except that it only runs on this. And that's because the guarded fabric is talking to this thing called the host guardian service. The host guardian service lives in a separate trust domain, keywords here, separate trust domain. That's where the keys actually reside. All right? So what does this mean? It means that VMs can only reside on the Contoso fabric. And even if a bad guy gets the admin credentials, or B, a good admin has a bad day and puts them on a USB stick and takes them home, when he puts them on his laptop and fires them up, they won't run. When he tries to mount them, they won't mount. When he tries to look inside them, he can't, because they are completely encrypted. He can't mount them, he can't run them, he can't stare inside them, because his laptop can't talk to the host guardian service, and even if it did, it would say, well, your laptop is not part of the Contoso.com fabric, so it won't run. This is huge. Like, literally nobody has this. And this is actually born out of work we've been doing in Azure about key management and protecting and encrypting your VMs and your work up in Azure. We've been thinking about this long and hard, how we bring this down to on-premises, and that's what we're doing here. So, couple of the key technologies here. Let me be very clear. You have to have multiple technologies in play to do this. There isn't a single silver bullet. The first one is a thing called virtual secure mode. I mentioned to you issue one. I am local admin. I can see everything, including memory and including encryption keys on this system, not with virtual secure mode. Virtual secure mode uses hardware and creates a separate little enclave on the side. The Windows kernel doesn't even know it's there. Thus, the host admin can't see it. This memory is out of the view of a host admin. Virtual secure mode is where the keys are stored. Little tiny kernel running in there that manages those keys. VSM. Nobody has this. On top of this, the second thing is you need the host guardian service. This is so we can attest that the fabric is who we say it is, and only the right servers that are on this fabric can run shielded VMs. And then finally, we have a shielded VM, which includes a virtual TPM in the virtual machine. Now let me be very clear. A virtual TPM alone does nothing. I've been asked this so many times over the years. Jeff, would you just put a virtual TPM in the Hyper-V VM and we'll all be done? No, you won't be done. Doesn't fix the problem. Not at all. If I give you just shielded VMs, or just hosted guarded service, or even any two of these, it doesn't matter. You have to have all three to create this secure context for shielded VMs. That's what makes this so important. All right, I gotta move on because I'm about to run out of time. I told you I had a ton of content. All right, next generation application platform. Let's get to it. Who's heard of containers? Anybody? Pretty good number. Excellent. All right. Containers, I very much feel like I'm having a deja vu moment all over again. I feel like it's virtualization in 2003. That's what's going on with containers. Okay? Everybody's running around saying, oh my gosh, containers are the greatest thing ever. It's going to solve all of the world's problems. Your children will be happier. Your hair will grow back more lustrous than ever. Your car will get better gas mileage. Everybody will be happy. Just use containers. And then I've heard all the crazy FUD too. Containers are going to kill VMs. No, VMs are going to kill containers. No. I expect containers and VMs will be around a very, very long time. After I retire, I'll be using them both. But they work great together, by the way. So what are containers? What's going on? And most importantly, why do I care? Because there's so much hyperbole, but no one's getting to the real important point is, why should I use containers in the first place? Containers are about a way to package an application in an easy way so they can be consumed for rapid development for DevOps. Simple scenario. Hi, I'm Jeff. I'm writing an application. This application has an executable. It's got some shared libraries. It's got some frameworks. Done. This application is my Mona Lisa. It is perfection. I write this every day. I compile it every day. It works perfectly on my laptop. When I finish this, I'm going to get a raise. I'm going to get a bonus. The company's going to do great. This is going to be wonderful. I'm done. I pass this to IT and I say, IT, go deploy my Mona Lisa. IT says, I'd be thrilled to. I'm happy to. Okay, here's the docs. I'm going to read the docs. All right, here's what I need to do. I'm going to go deploy it. All right, doesn't work. He said this was perfect. He said this was Mona Lisa. He said this was okay, well, hold on. Let me try it again. And IT people, God bless us, the IT pros out there, they'll read the docs 100 times. Not working. Sends an email back to the developer. Says, hey, developer, you know what? It's not working. Developer says, no problem. Here's a couple tools to try. Here's some scripts to run. Send me some log files. We'll figure this out. But trust me, it's perfection. I know. I've compiled it every single day. It runs flawlessly. Sends it back to IT. IT still can't get it to work. Sends an email back to dev. Dev is now furious. Dude, this is my Mona Lisa. You're not getting me my bonus. He sends an email to IT pro's boss. An IT pro comes down and says, do whatever you need to do to make this guy happy. We need to get this thing deployed. This application is super important. And the IT pro boss knows, hey, you know what? My bonus is riding on this application running, so do whatever you need to do to make it happy. So you know what the developer does? The developer says, let me fix your server. Give me admin access to your server. Does this sound familiar to anybody? Anybody? Just, yeah? Show of hands, anybody? Sound familiar? Oh, look at that! Yeah. So, IT pro, you don't want to make any waves. You know this is a bad idea. This is the last thing you want to do, but you got to let them work. So fine. You say, okay, here's admin access. Just please be good. So, developer, what does he do? Installs frameworks, installs debuggers, installs scripts, installs all sorts of stuff, and boom, now it works. Gives it back to IT and pro says, okay, here it is. It all works. I fixed your server. Thank you. Bye-bye. Done. So now IT pro looks at this server and says, what is this? I don't know what's in this server. I don't know what he installed. I don't know what scripts he put in here. I don't know what frameworks he added. So you know what I'm going to do? I'm going to take this server. I'm going to stick it over here in the corner. And I'm just going to hope that it continues to work. I'm going to back up the server. I don't know how to back up this application. I don't know how to make this thing work, but you know what? I just hope that, you know, it just continues to run. So you know what happens? The server sits in the corner until 10 years later, someone goes, hey, what's that server? Okay, so how do containers help with this? Here's how containers help with this. Developer writes his application. He has an executable. He's got shared libraries. He's got frameworks. He's got everything. It's my Mona Lisa. It's perfection. I take my application. I stick it in a container and hand the container to IT. And I say, IT, deploy this. And IT says, no problem. Fires up the container. And it just works. Because the container has all of the dependencies. It has the frameworks. It has the DLLs. It has everything in there. It's also protected in its own little extra special application isolation bubble. Containers allow us to essentially virtualize user mode. Kernel mode is still shared. These are not VMs. Anybody who tells you a container is a VM does not know what they are talking about. Run the other way. I'm tired of having this argument. Containers have a virtualized user space on top of a shared kernel. There are pros and cons. The pros are performance. Developers always say, these are the fastest things ever because they talk directly to the metal. You're absolutely right. There's no virtualization. In a VM, I have a hardware, and then I create VMs on top, and each one of those VMs is hardware isolated. I can run 2003, XP, Windows 7, Windows 8, Windows 10, 2012, all of these in isolated in their own virtual machines. On a container system, if this is running Windows Server 2016 and I fire up a container, that container is still talking to Server 2016. This container is still talking to Server 2016. This container is still talking to Server 2016. And every one of them is talking to Server 2016. So you don't get heterogeneous OS support. There's no running Linux on top of this. Okay? It's shared kernel virtualized user mode. Okay? Now, there's some real goodness here. Because it means when my developer writes his application, he can be quick about it. He hands me a container, I deploy the container, it goes. If he hands me one in an hour and says, here's your container, guess what? It just goes. I can build containers every 10 minutes and deploy them, and they will just work every single time. There's no patching, there's no, okay, you gotta write an installer, you gotta write a patcher, you've got to deal with how do I deal with dynamic patching. No. You turn a container on, you can turn a container off, and because a container is running on a kernel mode that's running, they fire up in like a fraction of a second. You can fire up literally dozens of containers in just a couple of seconds. And the memory usage is dramatically smaller, because in a VM, you have to have memory for the OS as well as the application. In a container, you only need the memory for the application because you're sharing the OS. So it's on generally like a 10x reduction in memory. That's huge, okay? But there are pros and cons. All right, so containers. We've got physical, we've got virtual, we've got containers. Containers can run on VMs. Containers can run on physical. There's a lot of reasons to do both. Most people today are running containers on VMs just because the technology is so new and they want to be able to check these in and out of VM libraries and deal with it that way. But containers can run in any of these constructs. Here's what the flow looks like. A developer will build an application. They will build and test their applications in containers. They will then push it to a central repository. This could be within your organization. This could be public, like up on GitHub. Then operations will automate the deployment and monitor those applications from the central repository. And in fact, now operations and development can work closer together, provide metrics, and in fact, you know what, we can improve performance. You know what, great, I'll give you a build in 20 minutes with some performance tweaks. We roll out a new container, great. It increased performance, but it introduced some instability. So let's roll back to the last one. So I'll just pull the last version container off the shelf, run it, and again, it runs flawlessly. So it allows you to deploy applications very quickly to instantiate, run, and develop in a very collaborative fashion. Now, you may be wondering, in the world of containers, a very common company you'll hear about is a company called Docker. Docker containers is how people tend to refer to them. It's actually incorrect. Docker doesn't make containers. Containers are a feature of the operating system. So for example, Linux has containers. And in fact, if you want, Azure has Linux containers running up on Azure right now. Linux has containers, Red Hat, Ubuntu, all the different distros have them. Windows Server has containers. And in fact, in the technical preview for Server 2016 available today, you can kick the tires on Windows Server containers. And in fact, Hyper-V containers are coming out very, very soon, within the next week or so. So, Docker containers. Docker is basically the management tools that allow you to provision, deprovision images in a very quick fashion using containers. The reason why I bring this up is because if you're using Docker today, Windows Server containers will use the same exact tools that you use with Docker. So if you know how to use all of your Docker push-pull commands to deploy containers, it's the same exact commands, so all of your developers already know how to use it. We've been working very closely with Docker guys in public. You can see all of our contributions up on GitHub. We're doing all of this work in the open with the open source community. Now, I want to point out one quick thing. We're actually introducing two types of containers. Here's why. Windows Server containers, like I mentioned before, containers have a shared kernel. This can be a pro and it can be a con. In the pro sense of the word, it's a pro because it's very fast. On the con, if you work in a heavily regulated environment, finance, healthcare, oil and gas, and you have to go get certification for regulation, we talked to those guys. We said, hey, how do you feel about containers? And they said, oh yeah, we hate those. What? Oh yeah, we hate those. Why do you hate those? Well, because in a virtual machine, everything is isolated. Every VM is hardware isolated. There's no sharing going on. In a container, you have a shared kernel mode. That's the last thing you ever want to tell a regulator, that you have shared components. So rather than argue with them, we said, you know what? You're right. So we created a second type of container called a Hyper-V container. These are in fact exactly the same for one difference. When you create your container, it's the same. When you deploy that container, there's a checkbox. Is this a Windows Server container or a Hyper-V container? If it's a Hyper-V container, we'll put up the Hyper-V shields for you, and it now has the hardware isolation that you would expect from a virtual machine. So guess what? Now you will pass the compliance and regulatory audit. If you want to run this on-premises in your private cloud, you can use either one. If it's a production one that you're running and you have a highly regulated environment, you're probably going to want a Hyper-V container. If you're in a public cloud where you don't know who the other tenants are on the server, you're absolutely going to want a Hyper-V container because you're going to want that extra layer of isolation. So that's why we did them both. All right, I am actually out of time, so I'm going to say one last quick thing. The best way to run all of that is with our new Nano Server. Nano Server is a new deployment option for Windows Server. Nano Server is tiny. To put this in perspective, full server today with GUI, Internet Explorer, the whole nine yards is about 4.5 gigabytes. Server core, the way we've been telling you to deploy and run Windows Server for the last 10 years, is about 2 gigabytes. Nano Server is 147 megabytes on disk. 147 megabytes on disk. From a patching standpoint, we did the analysis. If you were running this over the last year, you patched and rebooted your server about 24 times. If you use server core like we told you, it was 11 times. It was over 50% reduction. If this was Nano Server, you would have rebooted your server one time. This is where we are going in a very, very big way. Nano Server is optimized and it's designed to run on your physical hardware. It'll be the perfect Hyper-V host. It'll be the perfect host for your storage. It'll also be perfect to run in VMs and containers. So, from a management standpoint, you can all use all of your traditional management tools. We will also include this really awesome, cool web UI that looks very similar to Azure Stack, so you can manage Nano Server. All of Nano Server can be managed remotely. And in fact, you can't even log into Nano Server locally. It's all done remotely. So with that, I've got a call at the end of the day. I'm already out of time. I want to say thank you guys very much. The important thing I want to point out again is the question you should ask yourself is, where do you want to be in the next 5 years, in the next 10 years? Is it all running on premises? Is it in our public cloud? Is it with a service provider? Or most importantly, is it hybrid? Because that's exactly what we're doing, and that's exactly what our cloud strategy is. And I urge you to try out Operations Management Suite and download the Windows Server 2016 and System Center 2016 technical previews. Thank you very, very much, and enjoy the rest of the time here at the Technical Summit.